on great radio stations all across America. It's The National Defense with Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry.
The National Defense is made possible by Ford. Go further. By The Home Depot. More saving, more doing. By Subway. Get the Subway footlong sub of the day for just $6. It's a different featured footlong every day of the week. The Subway $6 footlong sub of the day. At participating restaurants, extras additional plus tax, no additional discounts or coupons applied. By PenFed Credit Union. PenFed's got great rates for everyone. And by Sam's Club. Sam's Club is thanking those who serve. Active and former members of the U.S. military are invited to join or renew their membership with up to $25 gift cards simply for signing up. Join or renew today. See Club for details.
This is the National Defense, Randy Miller, along with Jerry Newberry. As always, our dedication.
Hey, this show's for you, the men and women serving on active duty in the Guard and Reserves. It's for the millions of veterans out there, and it's for all their families. We're here for you. We love you. God bless you.
All right, Jerry, here we go.
I'm standing at attention.
You should be standing at attention.
I am.
General Jack Keane is with us. He's a retired four-star general, former vice chief of staff of the U.S. Army, chairman of the Institute for the Study of War, and a Fox News military analyst is where you can see him. Everybody now going, oh, I know General Keane from my TV set. General, we just had your old boss on here a couple of weeks ago, George W. Bush.
Oh, that's wonderful. Glad to hear that.
Did you know he was a painter?
Yes, I did.
He's doing well at it. How are you?
I'm doing well, quite busy, of course, with the national security challenges we have in the world, and with the new administration that's adjusting to those challenges and taking a completely different role for America in the world today, that's for sure.
Well, and if we can go back to George W. Bush for a second, it was pretty outstanding. You were really one of the architects of the surge when that came to be, and how was that interaction with the president?
Well, that was a very difficult time for him. It may have been the most difficult of his presidency, except for the events surrounding 9/11, of course. Because for 3 years, from 2003 to 2006, while it wasn't evident in early 2003, began to show some signs in 4 and definitely in 5, and of course went off the charts in 6, and that is that our strategy was not working in Iraq to defeat the Al-Qaeda and the Sunni-based insurgency, which grew rather exponentially. And that strategy was fundamentally flawed. And you know, for our audience to know, the United States military gets off on a wrong foot a number of times, from the Revolutionary War to Civil War, World War One to a lesser degree, World War Two in both theaters, we got off on the wrong foot. Korean War for sure, and Vietnam most definitely. And so here the strategy was wrong, and Bush wanted to change it, but they didn't know what to go to. They were asking the military, active duty military, what's wrong here, guys? Can't we do something else? And, you know, they really didn't think they should change the strategy. That's General Abizay, General Casey, and Secretary Rumsfeld. And when I realized that the strategy was failing, I took it first to Secretary Rumsfeld, then the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Peter Pace. But they weren't going to change it. And then eventually, with no solicitation on my part, I got called over to the Oval Office with some others who had at least espouse an alternative to what we were currently doing. And after I had the opportunity to share those thoughts with the president and his entire staff that was present in the Oval Office, within about 48 hours, they decided to shift to that strategy. Mm. And that was very courageous on his part, in my view, because the Democrats had certainly given up on the Iraq War a long time before that. They had just had, the Republicans were in trouble as a result of the November 2006 election. Then Rumsfeld got fired after that. So there was palpable fear in the White House in terms of where they were going. They knew they were failing. They just didn't know how to rheostat it and fix it. And so what my contribution was is the sensitivity to change was already there. What I was able to do for them is give them an idea of something they could do. I try to operationalize it for them so they can understand it. And what we put in play was an urban counterinsurgency that had been successful in other places, and they adopted that. And so he had to stand up to his Republican base Democrats had given up on him. He had to stand up to his generals, the field commanders, and the Joint Chiefs, who didn't want to change. And he did it anyway.
But well, I find it, this is very intriguing. You talk about palace intrigue. You as a general officer, I mean, you in essence went around the chain of command. You bypassed Secretary of Defense, and you gave your opinion on what should be done. Weren't you worried there might be some blowback on you?
Well, I always spoke up strongly when I was on active duty. I'm in a retired status in this case, in any event. But the first person I briefed on a change of strategy was Secretary Rumsfeld. And I was on his defense policy board as a retired general officer, and I had shared my thoughts with Henry Kissinger, Paul Wolfowitz, and Newt Gingrich, and they all said, "You got to see the president." I said, "Well, I'm not going to see the president. I'm going to go see Secretary Rumsfeld. That's who I'm working for on the Defense Policy Board." And of course, I talked to General Pace, but neither one of them were willing to make the change. And I think Secretary Rumsfeld certainly suffered the consequences of his unwillingness to do that, because a couple of months later he was, you know, removed from office. But you know, I knew where the field commanders were, and I not only asked, but we should change the strategy. I thought they should be removed. And I told that to the president and also to Rumsfeld and Pace.
Did you have any, and where was General Petraeus at this time?
He was at Fort Leavenworth, a three-star general in charge of school, what we call the Army Schoolhouse there. It's actually the Command and General Staff College that we have there. Meanwhile, yeah, he and a guy by the name of Jim Mattis, who was over, had an equivalent job on the Marine Corps, they and their staffs were writing a counterinsurgency strategy,
right,
that could be applied to any warfare. Because what we did after the Vietnam War, even though we defeated the insurgency and knew how to do that, we purged it from our lexicon because the war ended politically so unsatisfactorily. And the generals at the time, we stopped teaching it. So the problem we had is, we didn't know how to fight this kind of war, and Petraeus and Mattis putting some doctrine in place that would serve us well for years to come. But we had to make a decision, you know, before that doctrine got in place, and that decision had to be made by the commander-in-chief. And I have tremendous respect for George Bush for stepping up and doing that.
General Jack Keane on the program. We'll be right back here on the National Defense.
This is the National Defense.
The National Defense is made possible by CVS and the CVS Minute Clinics, the cure for the common weight, and by SelectQuote. Since 1985, we shop, you save.
Welcome back to the National Defense. Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry and General Jack Keane is our guest, retired four-star general, former vice chief of staff of the U.S. Army, chairman of the Institute for the Study of War, and a Fox News military analyst. General Keane.
Now, what was the conversation going on with Afghanistan? I mean, we all know that resources were directed towards Iraq, but what kind of conversations was Afghanistan just kind of put on the back shelf? There was absolutely no priority assigned to it, or what was going on there?
Well, the ease of victory contributed to some of our decisions, because we made George Tenet made a proposal at a principals meeting at the National Security Council that, as opposed to going through a huge buildup here, which would take weeks, you know, to get our forces there, why don't we try putting my guys in there first with the Northern Alliance tribes and see which ones would work with us, and then we'll bring in some special forces guys and work with the Northern Alliance against the Taliban and integrate our special forces, certainly, and the Northern Alliance with our very powerful air power capability. And that was, and then if that doesn't work, we could always go to the other military option, you know, building up our forces, which you've seen us do in Iraq and other places. So that turned out to be a brilliant recommendation, because the Taliban, by Thanksgiving, the Taliban was down. The regime had been removed, and that was just, you know, barely a couple of months after 9/11, obviously, and all of that had been accomplished. The ease of that victory, I think, also contributed to some bad decisions we made. We toppled the regime, but we never brought in the resources necessary to build an effective security force, because they didn't have any. They just had some militia, and they weren't any good. And we never committed the resources to that. We tried to convince Secretary Rumsfeld that he had to commit more resources to this, that we had to build an effective security force. And that was a mistake, and I think we didn't commit to that. And then in December of 2001, now here's the date I'm telling you, December 2001 is when the administration made the decision that we were going to go to war in Iraq. So by 2002, we began to move resources towards Iraq, satellite coverage, CIA, special ops, all the kinds of things that we need to have to go into a war that would be considerably more demanding than what we were just dealing with in Afghanistan. So what happened then, to use my words, we put Afghanistan on a diet, and it never did have the proper security forces to deal with the situation that eventually evolved. And we found ourselves, by 2004, the Taliban were reemerging. But by that time, we were knee-deep in a war in Iraq that we did not expect to be fighting. We didn't bring the troops home. The troops were stayed there en masse, some 150,000. And we were not able to put any more forces into Afghanistan until late 2008, after the surge had succeeded. Then we had troops available to send to Afghanistan, and then Obama put some more in there in 2009. But he never put the troops in, that the number of troops that the generals wanted. He gave McChrystal and Petraeus 25% less forces and pulled them out in 15 months. And that doomed Afghanistan to a protracted war that we cannot win. And that's the status we have right now after almost 16 years, which is horrific. In my judgment, the United States can't help a country win a war against guys running around with lightly armed rifles and IPG, RPGs, and homemade explosive devices.
Hey, Jerry, this is fascinating stuff. I mean, General Jack Keane, he's got a lot to say.
Yep,
we're
going to
hear
sure
all
does.
Of it. We'll be right back here on the National Defense. Welcome back to the National Defense. It's Randy Miller and Jerry Newberry. Hey, we're talking to General Jack Keane here on the National Defense. General, let me take you back to Vietnam for just a second, because you got another screaming eagle here in the room.
Wow, I'm impressed.
Rakusan.
Yeah, Rakusan is good. I was in the old Deuce and went on to be the chief of staff of that great division. After I was a platoon leader and company commander, then an assistant division commander. Eventually, I was a commanding general for almost 3 years.
Yeah.
General, let's talk about what's happening now in our country.
Sure.
What do you see in terms of the current climate, and especially with North Korea?
Well, I think what has happened, if I can just set a strategic stage for you, I think what the Trump administration has actually done, and we didn't know this was going to happen because the rhetoric in the campaign was a little different, and we didn't know what to make of about isolationist comments, anti-NATO comments, comments about the Middle East. We didn't know how the threat of all of that would actually come together in terms of national security policy. But now, after 90 days, it is clear that a national security policy is emerging, and this is what I think it is. President Trump is returning the United States to the world stage as its indispensable global leader promoting stability and security. And in support of that, he has dispensed his cabinet, senior cabinet officials and vice president to our allies all around the world to reassure them that the United States has their back. That is what's going on right now with Vice President Pence. Before that, it was Secretary Tillerson. Before that, it was Secretary Mattis. In South Korea, in Japan. That's the reason why the carrier strike group is heading up to the Korean Peninsula. It's about our allies to reassure them. And the same thing happened in Europe within the first 30 days. He had Vice President there, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and even General Kelly of the Homeland Security Department was there. That is absolutely unprecedented. Same thing in the Middle East. Reassure all of our allies.
But the
reason for that is because of 8 years of the Obama administration and their disengagement from the world. Our allies have become intimidated. They don't believe we are a reliable ally and trustworthy. And President Trump, that was given to him in spades, somewhat during the campaign, but considerably more during a transition. Then he started to get briefings, and I think some of those briefings actually alarmed him. So that is step one. The second thing is he is willing to confront our adversaries. He confronted the Iranians almost immediately when they fired a missile and slapped sanctions on them, and we haven't heard much from them since. We'll see if they raise their head again. He put the military option on the table dealing with North Korea, and we all know that the Obama administration did not have it on the table. Now, what happened as a result of that? For the first time in 20-plus years, the Chinese are talking to us about their ability to leverage North Korea to denuclearize. That conversation we have never had from a positive perspective. I'm absolutely convinced there's two reasons why the Chinese are doing that. One is the North Koreans have gotten considerably more aggressive and therefore more dangerous. And two, Trump has the military option on the table. So it has strengthened our diplomatic hand in trying to get a peaceful outcome to a dangerous situation. Same thing in Syria. He made a decisive decision to go after Assad based on the chemical weapons. But what he was really doing also is confronting and embarrassing and humiliating the Russians and the Chinese. So we have a different administration here in terms of the execution of national security policy, returning America to its more historical, traditional role as a global leader in a world that other countries truly depend on. Not looking for fights when we don't need one, backing up allies, and also contributing to the general increase in prosperity in the world.
But on the flip side of that, General, I mean, just to be devil's advocate here, that the reassurances that had to be made was, let's face it, President Trump says a lot of things, he tweets a lot of things, and there's nothing that he had said early on in the early days that gave any of our allies confidence. I mean, he said NATO was obsolete, and a lot of remarks. So the fact that he was sending people out to provide reassurances was in fact necessary because of some of the things he said.
I don't dispute that.
Our NATO allies. I think you know as well as I do that a lot of our NATO allies had people killed in Afghanistan. They fought shoulder to shoulder, and that was a motto adopted by the U.S. command. Commanding the NATO forces shoulder to shoulder. And President Trump doesn't seem to be well-versed in world events. Some people challenged the move he made in Syria, and I'm not objecting to that at all. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the bomb should have been dropped on Assad.
Absolutely.
That whether or not that's going to move Putin, I doubt it. And as far as threatening military action in Korea, do you really personally think that crazy SOB ruling North Korea is intimidated at all about threat of military action?
What he's about is preserving his regime. That's why he's got nuclear weapons. What's made him dangerous is his grandfather and father developed the nuclear weapon capability, but he's developing a delivery system.
Right.
He's accelerating and racing at a staggering pace to that delivery system, and he keeps talking about how he intends to use it. So despite the irrational aspect of that, the lack of logic, because if you have these systems and you're main purpose is to preserve your regime so that you can stay in power. Why would you get yourself in a fighting war with the one country in the world that can destroy your regime? That's the illogic and the irrational aspect of it.
How can
you ignore what he's saying, and how can you ignore the capabilities of that? To do that is to do what Obama did, which just encourages it. Encourages that kind of behavior. We got to bring this behavior to a halt. And the threat of force, if you have a credible threat of force, it becomes a powerful diplomatic tool to get yourself a peaceful answer. Well, and that's something that the previous president was never willing to step up to, because he always feared escalation.
Well, I went online the other day, and I pulled up some sound bites from George W. Bush and President Obama, and they both at various times said, if things in North Korea got out of hand, North Korea knows that we would incinerate them. So to me, what I'm hearing when I heard those two say that's military action. I guess my question is, how is that any different than what President Trump is saying? And also, how do you picture the military action taking place? What would happen to South Korea, for example?
Well, any military action that we took would provoke a war. And that's the reality of it. So if he has missiles in a launch position, and we believe they can reach the United States, he has developed submarine based ballistic missiles. Uh-huh. He test-fired them successfully. He had six of them on display. And for our audience to understand that, we're talking about submarines moving around the Pacific with nuclear weapons. We don't know if he has weaponized those missiles yet, but he's heading towards that capability. Now, those submarines are not as quiet as our submarines, but nonetheless, that is a significant threat. Not talked very much about in the media, but it's a significant threat. He has test fired one ICBM, but he never reached the final stage of it. That would be able to reach the United States if he succeeds at that. He has medium range ballistic missiles that he's test-fired successfully that can reach most of our U.S. bases in the Pacific and all of our allies. So those are real capabilities that we can't ignore. So if he was in a position to launch these, and we believe that they're weaponized, then we would have to go into a military regime to deal with that. I mean, what we would do is take out those facilities. We would take out as much of his rocket and artillery as we possibly could that's propped up near the border between South Korea and North Korea. For our audience to know, that Seoul's within 30 miles, so he's got the right capability to range that. That would create tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of casualties if we didn't take it out. We would take out his deeply buried nuclear facilities as well, and we would go to Pyongyang and take out as many leadership targets as we possibly could to destroy the regime. That would mean he would unleash his ground forces also into South Korea with as much artillery as he's got left, fire as many rockets as he has left, and we'd have a war on our hands. Now, we don't want to do that, obviously, but no president of the United States is going to sit there and let Korea fire a ballistic missile towards our allies or towards one of our bases or towards the United States. No president could do that.
Right.
But I think the fact that you actually put it on the table and you are and people believe that you would do that, and I believe we would if we had to, that Obama never talked about that. He was talking about the incendiary aspect of a nuclear war. In other words, they start something nuclear with we will incinerate them. And what we're talking about here is preventing that from ever happening.
Well, okay. I guess, in my view, if that would be a proper response, if he was going to fire a nuclear weapon, you give it to him. So, in other words, if we provided a response, the peninsula, in essence, would be lost to the north. Now, what would happen with China? What do you think would happen? What would they do?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they would know the regime is going to be lost, and are they going to really fight for that?
Don't they want that? Wouldn't they want that peninsula for themselves?
The thing that China doesn't want is the destabilization of the Korean Peninsula, and they've been playing a very dangerous game for a long time, ever since the Koreans became so bellicose, with what they were with provocations. And they kind of like the fact that the Chinese stick us in the eye with North Korea's belligerence, and because it takes our eye off the ball in terms of what their regional objectives are. I'm talking about the Chinese and militarizing the South China Sea.
Sure.
Obviously, to gain influence and control over our allies, the West China Sea as well, in terms of Japan. Those are serious geopolitical moves that China is making, and they kind of enjoy this tension. But what has happened is the Koreans have got considerably worse at it because of the acceleration of the missile development, and Donald Trump is different from President Obama, and he has managed to convince the Chinese of that. You know, after the Mar-a-Lago thing, that, you know, backslapping, handshaking, good food, all the rest of it, good conversation, he did tell them that I'm going to need your help with North Korea. I'm willing to make some concessions to get your help here. The president of China called them back the following Wednesday night, talked to them for an hour. It takes a little longer dealing with an interpreter. And he told them in that conversation that he is going to put together a plan to leverage North Korea in an attempt to denuclearize it. And then his foreign minister called Tillerson this last Sunday and had a similar conversation with a little bit more details in it. So what do we know as a result of that? We know that Trump has been able to move a Chinese leader to a position that no other president has. That's number one. Number two, we don't know if they're gaming us, if that rhetoric is ever going to turn into some kind of substantive action and we get a favorable result. Are they going to just move in that direction for a while so we take our attention off of the crisis in North Korea? And meanwhile, they get some pretty good concessions out of the deal.
Right.
We don't know those answers. But we're in a better position with North Korea this week than we were 2 weeks ago. That much I know, because the Chinese, at least in rhetoric, are saying they intend to move in that direction.
Man, it's a fascinating conversation.
Yeah.
General Jack Keane is our guest, retired four-star general, former vice chief of staff of the U.S. Army, chairman of the Institute for the Study of War, and a Fox News military analyst. General Keane, right here on the National Defense. Okay, welcome into the CVS Minute Clinic Minute. We're here with Army veteran, Minute Clinic nurse practitioner Holly Kautz. Holly, tell us about allergies.
Oh, gosh. Well, we're getting into that season. And as I've mentioned to you before, you can see allergies all year round, depending on what people are allergic to. But we are starting to actually see pollen season hit in certain states. And so it tends to cause you to have itchy eyes and nose, more tears than normal, postnasal drip, runny nose, scratchy throat, sneezing, sometimes a stuffy nose.
Did air purifiers help at all?
Yeah, I think they can help a little bit. Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of the recommendations that we have is to run the air conditioner even when it's mild, because it does some of that purification of the air.
And so what can people, when they go to the Minute Clinic, what can you guys tell them if they have allergies? What do you recommend in terms of medications?
Sure. Well, we usually recommend to start with just some over-the-counter antihistamines like Claritin or Zyrtec. If they have a more severe type of allergy, then sometimes we will add some Flonase, because those two things tend to work very synergistically together, meaning that they work better together than they do alone. And we make some recommendations like not bringing the pollen in with you, so changing your clothes right away when you get home, vacuuming regularly, having a really nice vacuum with a good HEPA-rated air purifier to remove the allergens from the environment. Certainly, you can do things like covering your pillowcases with plastic when you're not sleeping. I know that's kind of drastic, but if your allergies are really bad, it might be worth it. And not having too many stuffed animals around, because those types of things trap those allergens.
Gary, get rid of your stuffed animals.
My real animals.
Get rid of your real animals, yeah. Thank you, Holly. We'll be back here next week with a brand new Minute Clinic Minute from CVS.
This has been the National Defense, made possible by Ford. Go further. By the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. By SelectQuote. Since 1985, we shop, you save. By Subway. Introducing the Italian hero from Subway, stacked with capicola, mortadella, and Genoa salami with oil, vinegar, and oregano. Taste the authentic flavor of the Subway Italian hero, limited time only. By PenFed Credit Union. PenFed's got great rates for everyone. By United Airlines. Proud to employ veterans across our entire airline. By CVS and the CVS Minute Clinics. The cure for the common weight. By ADT Security, for over 140 years, your first line of defense. And by Sam's Club. Sam's Club is thanking those who serve. Active and former members of the U.S. military are invited to join or renew their membership with up to a $25 gift card simply for signing up. Join or renew today. See Club for details.
Hey, Frankie, what you got there?
It's an Italian hero from Subway.
A lot of meat on that sandwich.
Well, yeah, Mrs. G, it's got mortadella, spicy capicola.
Capicola? Nice.
Genoa salami, oil and vinegar.
Is that Mediterranean oregano I smell?
Yeah, Mr. Antonelli.
What did I tell you? That thing is loaded.
That's a nice sandwich. You did good, Frankie. Real good.
Thanks, Sal. Thanks. Everybody?
Subway has the authentic taste everyone loves. Introducing the Italian hero. It's our better Italian flavor for a better Subway. Limited time only.
Look, you can't go a week without hearing how the Ford F-150 is way ahead, leaving every other truck choking on its gravel. And when it comes to safety, the truck that leads the pack is the high-strength, military-grade, aluminum alloy body Ford F-150. F-150 is the only pickup to earn both of the most important safety ratings in America. First, it earned the government's highest overall safety rating, 5 stars, for all sides and all cab configurations. And now, F-150's earned the IIHS top safety pick on Super Cab and Super Crew with optional forward collision warning. It's leadership like that that's made Ford F-Series America's number one brand of trucks for 39 straight years. So let's review. F-150 is the only pickup to earn both safety ratings. Once again, raising the bar for what a truck should be. This is the safest Ford F-150 ever, and every other truck is history.
Government 5-star safety ratings are part of the National Highway Safety Traffic Administration's new car assessment program. Tests include driver and passenger front side and side barrier pull tests.
Sam's Club is thanking those who serve with up to a $25 gift card simply for signing up. So whether you're an active or former member of the U.S. military, we invite you to join or renew your membership, where you can get thousands of dollars in instant savings, where you'll find fresh foods and unexpected treasures at low prices every day, where saving time is possible with the convenience of scan-and-go checkout. Stop by or visit samsclub.com/military for more. Thank you for your service. Join or renew today.